All right, we're on the home stretch. When you engage people, it is important that you do so in a way that invites dialogue, doesn't repel. And my colleague Greg Kokel has come up with a tactic he refers to as the Columbo tactic. Now, for you youngsters in the room, Columbo was this detective, but he wasn't your normal, suave, Sherlock Holmes kind of character. He is rather unkempt. He wears clothes that look like about 30 years out of style, and he's not the most well-groomed gentleman you've ever met. Walks around with a chewed-up cigar and a pen in his hand, and he'll come up on the scene, and the crooks are just thrilled to see him because they think this guy is so dumb, he'll never figure it out. What they don't know is he's dumb like a fox, and he'll just keep asking questions. Now, Mr. Jones, where were you on the night of the 3rd? Okay, all right, I got it. Oh, just one more ding before I go. And he one more dings him to death. There's something bothering me about this, you know? And he would ask questions, and every single episode of Columbo, without exception, ended with one question that would just blow the whole case open. I remember one doctor, he had killed his wife and had been denying it. And Columbo, at the end of the show, leans against the wall of the kitchen, just sitting there talking to him. He says, you know, doctor, I got to hand it to you. I think you just about had me beat on this one. But I do have just one question for you. If you didn't kill Mrs. Smith, how did she get in the wall of your house? And he takes a big hammer, rips open the sheetrock, and out falls a body bag with Mrs. Smith in it. The good doctor had forgotten to take the wife's digital watch off her arm, and as he was leaning against the wall earlier in the show, he's hearing a beeping through the wall. That's Columbo, okay? So for those of you that have never been exposed to such treats, you have now. And it is great stuff. My colleague Greg Kokel, in his book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions, which you all should get, identifies three types of Columbo questions that are designed to get you out of the hot seat and back in the driver's seat. Here's the good thing about Christian apologetics. Christian apologetics is not walking around having answers to every possible thing that could pop up, and you are just so stinking smart, you're like a Western gunslinger that no one can shoot you down in the street. Actually, those guys do a lot of damage to our side because they're not generally very impressive to the people around them, and they tend to come off as rather cocksure and arrogant. So you're going to be better than that. You're going to learn to ask good questions, which give you time to think, allow you to exit the conversation and do further research if you need to, and feel no shame about it. Your job is to engage people in a conversation that may take longer than one session. I don't know. But here are the three questions that Greg identifies to help put you back in the driver's seat. First question, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Second question, how did you come to that conclusion? And third question, have you considered the implications of your view? What do you mean by that? Have you considered the implications of your view? Or excuse me, what do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? And have you considered the implications of your view? These three questions are not gotcha questions. They're designed to expose weaknesses in an opponent's argument, expose the flaws, and hopefully lead to clarity so you can help move the person toward clearer thinking on the issues we're talking about here. And the Columbo tactic, which is this process of asking these three questions, is outlined brilliantly for you in Greg's book. So again, I commend that to your reading. So let's walk through these three questions. I'll give you some examples of how you might use the question, and then we'll tie it together at the end. And then what I'm going to do, I've already got permission from Dick to do this, I'm going to cut my session short. I'm going to streamline this a little bit so I can allow about 10 to 15 minutes for you to ask questions about anything I've said here today. And you will be free to disagree with me, by the way. You'll be wrong, but you're free to disagree with me if you wish. All right. First Columbo question, what do you mean by that? I don't know how many of you used to watch Larry King. He's not on anymore, is he? Oh, all right, good. Anyway, Larry King, this had to be 10, 12 years ago at least, had Shirley MacLaine on one night. Shirley MacLaine is a witch. I'm not being derogatory. She calls herself that. All right? The topic of the night was the new spirituality. And she was discussing this with Larry King. And Larry said something like, well, you know, Shirley, we do need some new spiritual application, don't we? And she said, oh, yeah, we absolutely do. And Larry said, well, what do you think is a big problem? And she just, here's her answer. Well, we need a new spirituality because we all know the Bible's been changed many times. Now, Larry King, who was 106 at the time, was just nodding, right? I know, that was bad. He's just nodding. Didn't say a thing. You know what I would have said if I was on that show? Miss McLean, you just said the Bible's been changed many times. In what way? Or what do you mean by that? Do you see the problem? Do you think she would have been able to answer that? What was she doing? Asserting, just throwing out stuff. She is not schooled in biblical translation. She's not schooled in the big biblical documents one bit. She has no credibility on that issue. She was just making a bald-faced claim. I would have said, in what way has it been changed? How so? Now, this, by the way, is an inviting question because it just allows the person to clarify what they're making. But oftentimes, that will stop it right there. I've been in debates over embryonic stem cell research. This is where we take a human embryo, we grow it to about the 21-day stage, we kill that embryo so we can extract its stem cells to treat disease in people who are ill. That's embryonic stem cell research. And of course, as a pro-lifer, I argue against that. But in these debates that come up, I will get people who will say things like this. Well, embryos are just a clump of cells. What do you think my first question is going to be? What do you mean by that? How so? In what way? Excuse the objection, but if we wheeled a corpse into this room right now that had been dead 8 hours, would there be live cells in the body? A ton. You have live cells. So why is the corpse dead and you living? In the corpse, the cells have quit talking to each other. There's been an irreversible breakdown of the body's ability to function as a coordinated living organism. Is an embryo in that category? An embryo doesn't need a brain to live. You do. The embryo's in the category of not yet needing a brain. The dead person is in the category of no more having a coordinated body. You following me on this? Embryos are not mere clumps of cells like those on a corpse. They are living entities who undergo their own internally directed development, and to call them mere clumps of cells is complete ignorance. And people do it all the time. By asking the question, what do you mean by that? You can arrest that. Here's another one. Well, you're a Christian. Don't you know that science and faith exclude each other? What should your question be? What do you mean by science and what do you mean by faith? What do Christians mean by faith? Do we mean a blind leap in the dark? No, we don't. I had faith the airline was going to get me here when I left Atlanta yesterday. I looked up in the cockpit. There were two guys in uniforms who I knew had hundreds of hours of flying commercial aircraft. I looked at the airline I was on. It was Delta. Delta gets you there safely. Doesn't always get your bag there, but it gets you there. I've been told Delta stands for don't expect luggage to arrive. And we have a Delta employee in the room. I've, you know, already made friends with him last night. I looked in the cockpit. Two guys were pros. The airline, excellent safety record. Knew their maintenance was good. They do excellent work. I knew that airline travel is the safest way to travel anywhere, by far. It's not even close. I had faith that I would get here, But it wasn't blind faith. It wasn't faith in spite of evidence. It was trust based on evidence. Christianity is not a blind leap. It is trust based on evidence. What does Hebrews 11 tell us? Faith is what? The evidence of things unseen, the assurance of what? That's not a blind leap. That is trust based on evidence we see. When the apostles proclaim the gospel in the book of Acts, do they tell people, just believe it because we say so, or did they point to concrete things? Men and women, this Jesus of Nazareth, you killed, God raised him from the dead, and 500 people saw him after he rose from the dead. The Old Testament writers spoke of him. This is true to what the scriptures were speaking about. They didn't appeal to blind faith. They went after the evidence. And so what they're trying to do with this is paint you as a Christian as being the irrational one while they're the scientific one. Well, what do we mean by science? You know what they mean by science? They often don't mean science. They mean a worldview masquerading as science. Materialism is not science. The claim that science is the only truth is not science. That's a philosophical claim about science that can't be verified empirically. And by asking the question, what do you mean by science? What do you mean by faith? We can flush these things out to be clarified. Another thing that comes out is people say, as we mentioned a moment ago, you pro-lifers just force your views on people. Really? How so? What do you mean by that? You mean because we propose a view, we're somehow excluded from participating in our own government? You're an extremist. Oh, I love this one. I've been called this. When you're called a name, I want you to ask the person what they mean by the name. You're an extremist. What do you mean by that? Well, you always claim you're right. Allow me. Well, do you think you're right? Yes. So if I claim to be right, I'm an extremist, but if you claim to be right, you're just right. You see the problem with this? And by asking the simple question, what do you mean by that, you can clarify that. Okay, now we come to the question that I think is the most important one. What Kokel calls the queen mother of Columbo questions. How did you come to that conclusion? So you're sitting in a philosophy class, major university. The professor says, well, you know, this is a Bible for literature course we're in. We don't believe the Bible's true. We know it's made up of fables and stories. And you're sitting there going, oh boy, how do I refute this guy? Wait a minute. Is it your job to refute him? Who made the claim? Who bears the burden of proof? So here's your question. Very respectfully, Mr. Professor, you said the Bible's just a bunch of made-up stories. How did you come to that conclusion? What does he have to do now? Got to defend his place, right? It won't do for him to say, well, prove I'm wrong. He made the claim, not me. I'm just asking what his goods are. For all he knows, I agree with him. He's the one that has to be the one defending his claim. By the way, isn't it fun to play the skeptic sometimes? Make them do the hard work of defending the claim. Here's another one you'll get. Fetuses aren't self-aware, so how can they have a right to life? Now, from last night, those of you that were here, can you remember what would be a good question to ask at this point? Why does self-awareness matter? Tell me why it matters. I'd start right with that. Make them defend the claim that it matters that self-awareness is what gives us a right to life. I would not accept that claim. I'd make them defend it. Someone tells you Jesus' disciples made up the stories of the resurrection. Same thing. How did you come to that conclusion? What's your evidence for that? You're forcing them to defend their claim, and you're not letting them get away with it by just making an assertion. Another one you'll get, this one is always kind of fun. No one sees reality as it really is. You better be laughing. How many of you have heard of the blind man and the elephant story? It goes like this. The point of the story is to help us believe that There's no truth in religion. All religions see only a part, and no one religion should claim to be right. So here's the story. There's a bunch of men, blind men, and they're touching an elephant. One says an elephant is like a trunk, a tree trunk. He's got his arms around the leg of the elephant. The other says, no, it's like a snake. He's got his hand on the trunk, the actual trunk of the elephant. The other one says, no, it's like a spear. He's touching the tusks. Another one says, no, he's like a bush as he's touching the elephant's tail. You get the idea, right? And then finally, from up in the balcony, an all-wise, omniscient voice says, no, you're all mistaken. You are all only feeling a part of the elephant. The elephant is much more than that. And that fable is used to tell all of us that religion sees only a part of what reality is, and all the other world religions are adding to it as well. There really is no ultimate truth. There's no objective truth in religion. What's the problem with that little story? What question could you ask to kind of expose it? Exactly. Where are you in this story that you know what the truth is while everybody else is blind? How did he escape the blindness to get up in the balcony to tell us that we're all blind, right? Everybody's blind on religion except me. I can tell all of you you're blind. And my question would be, how did you come to the conclusion there's no truth in religion when you just got done telling us everybody's blind on it? We're forcing them to defend their own claim. And then the final question. Have you considered the implications of your view? This is where you show that they're paying too high a price for the view that they hold. So, for example, at a major, it was University of Maryland, actually. Same school that this guy that we read about a few minutes ago was at. I had done a pro-life talk there, laid out a case for the pro-life view, and a foreign exchange student from Indonesia raised his hand and said, I like that you didn't bring religion into this. I like that you brought science, but I can't buy your argument that embryos and fetuses have a right to life. I said, okay, well, give me your reasons. He said, I just can't accept that an embryo that is not even self-aware has a right to life. What do you think my question was? Tell me, why do I have to be self-aware to have a right to life? He just paused. And after, 8 seconds, he looked at me and said, touche. In other words, he recognized he had no argument for that being the decisive thing. Why would you believe a thing like that is what I was asking him. How did you come to the conclusion that self-awareness is what gives us value? He had not even thought about it. He was just mimicking it. And by asking the question, well, how did you come to that conclusion? But then it got better. I then got to bring the third Columbo tactic in. The third question, have you considered the implications of your view? I said, have you considered that if self-awareness is what gives us value, newborns are disqualified because they're not self-aware until several weeks after birth? Whoa. He said, I don't want to go there. I said, I don't either. See, showed that he was paying too high a price to hold that view. What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion? And have you considered the implications of your view? Now, there are fun ways to do this. You'll get the people who say to you, well, you shouldn't judge. And right away, you could ask what? Why are you judging me? Absolutely. If we're not to judge, why did you just offer one? That's a fair thing to show. They're paying too high a price. Okay, so let's walk through some typical pro-life things you might hear where you could ask, or I should say pro-abortion things you might hear where you could ask Columbo questions to clear things up, and then I'm going to stop and take questions for the remaining time that I get with you. Okay, somebody might come to you and say, well, you know, the law can't stop all abortions. What would be your first Columbo question? Well, what do you mean the law can't stop all abortion? Laws against rape don't stop all rape. Should we legalize rape? What do you mean the law doesn't stop? Do you mean the law can't stop all or the law can't stop most? No law stops all illegal behavior, but it stops most. We know that. We know that abortion rates went up after legalization, not down. So we know that's the case. My next thing would be, how do you know the law can't stop all abortions or stop most abortions? Are you familiar with legislation before Roe v. Wade and how that worked out versus where we are now? They haven't thought about that. And then, have you considered the implications of your view? If it's true that the law can't stop all behavior and therefore we ought to make it legal, that means we're going to have to legalize rape because we can't stop all rape either. We're showing they're paying too high a price to hold their view on these issues. Another one you'll get is when it comes to cloning. Cloning is not science fiction. It is now part of bioethics. Let me tell you what cloning is. Cloning involves creating an embryo from your genetic structure that is a near copy of you in terms of its physical properties and makeups, its genetic structure. Here's what we do. We take a vacated female egg cell. We strip the DNA out of it. We slap your donor DNA inside that vacated egg cell. We add chemicals and electricity and jolt it into reproducing as a clone of you. That cloned embryo is a living human being who bears the image of God. Our opponents like to draw a distinction between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning. And here's what they'll say. Well, we're against reproductive cloning for making a baby. Wait a minute. What difference is there between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning? Answer, none. The process is exactly the same in every case. The only question is, are we going to kill the cloned embryo or let him live? But the process of the female egg cell and putting the donor material in there, same exact process. So my question to my opponents are, what do you mean by cloning? They don't even know how to explain it to me, let alone explain how it should play out morally, and instead they just want to make this false distinction and think they've caused me to go away. No, it won't work that way. Tell me what you mean by cloning. What do you mean by it? They can't even explain the process to me. All cloning is reproductive because it results in a living human embryo that's one of us. It's all reproductive. The only question is, are we going to destroy that embryo or are we going to let him live? That's the only question here that we have to deal with. And yet, we get people that try to confuse us on this. Okay, this is one of my funniest stories. I'll do two more and then take your questions. My friend, Jojo Ruba, he's a Canadian guy. He was out in a college campus in Florida, University of Central Florida, and he'll come down and help pro-life groups do a display, the Genocide Awareness Project, which I told you about earlier. And a professor came up to him and said, those pictures of abortion are fake. Now, it'd be real easy to say, no, they're not. Yes, they are. No, Jojo was a lot smarter. He looked at the guy who was standing there with his students and said, you say those pictures are fake? Tell me, what do real abortion pictures look like? Game over. The guy said, well, I don't know, but those are fake. And so Jojo said, let me see if I understand you correctly. You're sure my pictures are fake, but you don't know what real ones look like. You think that was a bad moment for the professor in front of his students? Yeah, it was. It was a bad moment. And then Jojo brought in the implication question. Have you considered what you're saying here? If my abortion pictures are fake, why are you so upset about it? If abortion is no big deal, why be bothered by the pictures? He very skillfully dealt with that situation by simply saying, what do you mean they're fake? What do you mean? What do real ones look like? Game over. That was it. All right, I'll do one more and then I'll take your question. You'll get people who say the Bible is silent on abortion. I'm going to give you a little tidbit here. Stop using Psalm 139 to defend the pro-life view. Don't use Jeremiah 1:5. There's a better way to show that the Bible is pro-life. And I'll tell you what that is, and then I'll tell you how you can use the Colombo questions. Why do I say don't use Psalm 139? The Bible has several different genres of literature in it. Poetry, history, gospel, epistles. You get the idea, right? You interpret each kind of literature differently. You don't interpret everything literal because the authors didn't intend it to be literal. In Psalm 139, what kind of biblical literature are we dealing with? Epistles, gospels, poetry, or history? Poetry. Do you interpret poetry the same way you interpret an epistle? No, you do not. Here's the problem with Psalm 139. David's talking about God knitting him together in his mother's womb. We want to take that literally, don't we? He also talks about having communion with God at the bottom of the sea. Are we going to take that literally? You see the problem we run into? And a sharp critic will call us on this. Here's your way to defend the pro-life view from Scripture. All humans have value because they bear the image of God. Genesis 1 teaches this. James 3 teaches it. Old and New Testaments. Because humans bear the image of God, the shedding of innocent blood is strictly forbidden, meaning you cannot intentionally kill an innocent human being. Exodus 23:7 teaches that. Proverbs 6:16-19 teaches that. Matthew 5:21 reiterates it. So let's put these two together. All humans have value because they bear the image of God. Because they bear the image of God, the shedding of innocent blood is strictly forbidden. What's the only question we've got to ask here now? Are the unborn human, right? If they're human, the commands against the shedding of innocent blood apply to them just like they do every one of us. So let's grant that the Bible nowhere teaches that the unborn are human. Does the Bible teach that the Germans are human? Americans? The French? Some of you are going, wait a minute, no. What the Bible says is all humans have value. What does the science of embryology tell us? The unborn are what? Distinct, living, whole human beings. We don't need the Bible to call out every class of human beings for us. All we need to know is its general principle that all humans bear God's image. If they bear his image, they shouldn't be intentionally killed, and abortion intentionally kills an image bearer. That's all the scripture we need, folks. That is a rock-solid case. And I would argue that way rather than quoting scriptures that, by the way, I'm not saying Psalm 139 doesn't point to the humanity of the unborn. I'm saying it leaves you open to a criticism. That's all I'm saying. And it is absolutely true. Before anybody guesses, I believe in the authoritative truth of the Word of God. I'm not calling any of that into question. I just want us to be as careful as possible. So when somebody says to me, the Bible is silent on abortion, I'll say, what do you mean by that? Do you mean the word is never mentioned, or do you mean there's no truth that we can know about the subject from the scripture? Well, the word's not there. Well, the Bible doesn't mention a lot of things. Are you saying that whatever the Bible doesn't expressly condemn, it condones? When they say no, as they must, then what's your point? Nowhere in the scripture does it say, thou shalt not cut up your neighbor for shark bait, but that doesn't mean you can do it. We know from scripture, innocent human beings shouldn't be killed intentionally for whatever reason. I don't need an express condemnation to know it's wrong. So anyway, these are how you can use these Columbo questions to your advantage. And in my book, The Case for Life, I have a whole chapter on those Columbo questions. You can research that if you want. There's also Greg Kokel's excellent book, Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. And it's all, oh, good, Dick says we've got it. So what I want to do now is stop right here and take any questions from any of you have. We've got like 15 minutes left, and I will take any questions on the pro-life view, relativism, tactics, anything you've heard me say over the last night and today. And we'll go from there. So who's up first?
We're going to take your questions here so we can record them. But first, help us make a decision. We have this committee. And the committee kind of, and I, work together on who we should have return and who we should have come and speak. So close your ears. Would you have him back?
Yeah.
Have we wasted your time? So I just was going to check on that. There is, as a matter of fact, but you're not invited.
I get the students.
Pray for those, because it's real students. It really gets tough this afternoon. If you got a question, come to me and we'll record it too. Come on, don't be bashful.
By the way, I do want to say that I do talks all over the country, as you can imagine. When I see a guy who volunteers his time to set up talks like this, he's one of my heroes. Give it up for this guy, would you?
In your debates, do you address the economic issue of abortions and how that has affected our economic problem here now?
I don't, and I'll tell you why. And when I do a debate, my philosophy is say one thing, say it well. And I try to stay so on message that when that audience leaves, there's no doubt about what my message is. I want that syllogism in their head. I want the abortion pictures in their head. I want my scientific and philosophic case in their head. And so I try not to get distracted. Now, in the Q&A, if somebody brings it up and says, well, does abortion have an impact on the economic situation, I will address it then. But I don't proactively do it. Now, having said that, I have no problem if you bring those issues up, but I would make my case first. That's a secondary platform, not your primary one. The biggest problem we have in the pro-life movement right now is our messaging is all over the map. It's one of the reasons we're doing the program we're doing at Oklahoma Wesleyan University in the summer with the 2-week intensive courses. It's to help train pregnancy center directors, right-to-life people, how to stay on message and how to say the one thing we need to be saying well. And when we get too distracted, that's it. Now, one thing, that economic thing works both ways. You've got pro-lifers saying we're going to struggle from a top-heavy economy with too many elderly people and not enough young people to support them. The abortion choicers come along and say, actually, abortion has reduced crime, the Freakonomics thesis that they like to point to. That's not true. Actually, crime dropped because of the end of the crack wars. That's the main reason, but I don't want to get too deep into that. But I would stick to the things we've been talking about here for the most part.
Absolutely agree with you. And by the way, when Dr. Jay Adams was with us,
Mike.
The economist, the Catholic economist. Help me out.
Jay Wesley Richards?
Jay Richards.
Yep.
He did talk about the fact that we have lost economic value.
Oh, no
because,
doubt.
Because he's a capitalist. But that's a whole different thing than when you're in a debate.
Yep, absolutely.
Good question.
Is the Delta guy still here, by the way? Where was he? There. Oh, boy. I'm glad you're in the back, sir.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the correlation of the dehumanizing of the baby. You know, you hear the word fetus, and I don't know how many ladies have ever called their mother and said, guess what, Mom, I'm having a fetus.
Yeah.
Nobody does that. And then this easy wanton taking of life now that we read about all over the place. It seems like we've just made it life so...
Yeah, what about the word fetus? I'm actually quite comfortable with the word. It just means young one. It just means young one. You didn't say this, but there have been other pro-lifers who say that those of us who use the word fetus are responsible for babies dying. I find that very problematic. First of all, I generally don't call the unborn babies. Babies are what we get when they're born. My argument is not that abortion is wrong because it kills a baby. My argument is wrong because it intentionally kills an innocent human being regardless of his stage of development. So I don't want to link my argument strictly to a born baby that the public goes, oh, those aren't babies, no problem. So I use the word fetus. I have no problem with it at all. I'm fine with the word unborn. Some say, no, we should say preborn. It's a distinction without a difference. Either way is fine. What matters is the arguments we're making more than the labels we put on things. So I try to use labels that everybody will accept and make my argument compelling to them on logical grounds before I worry about the name things. Now, having said that, I'm not going to complain if you're a pro-lifer and you're making a presentation and you use the word baby. I would never critique you on it, never at all. But I'm just saying fetus is fine, too. It's absolutely fine. It's a proper term. It's Latin for young one. That's all it means. And maybe you define it for people if you're worried about using it. Yeah, good question. Thank
you. I'm looking for a question from somebody under 25 years old. Come on, let's go. Abby,
I just wanted to say that I remember reading, I think it was in Leviticus, that it actually says in the Bible that if a man strikes a pregnant woman and causes her to miscarry, he is guilty of murder and should be put to death. So the life, the Bible does say that there is a life in an unborn baby, fetus.
Yeah, what you're referencing there, Abby, is Exodus 21. And Exodus 21 presents a situation where two men are fighting, and there's a woman standing by who's pregnant. And as they're in the course of fighting, they make contact with her, and she either miscarriages or gives stillbirth. We don't know. The text isn't entirely clear there. And the lex talionis, as you rightly point out, applies there, meaning eye for eye, tooth for tooth, life for life. The thing about that passage, you didn't do this, but our opponents use that against us. And here's what they say. See, there's a lesser penalty if the child is harmed than the woman. Therefore, the Bible values the mother more than the child. Let's stop for a moment and even grant the premise that that were true. That same passage, a few verses later, presents a situation where a man intentionally kills his slave and escapes with no penalty at all. Does that mean the slave wasn't human? So the absence of a penalty doesn't mean an absence of humanness. Secondly, the abortionists are giving us a non sequitur. How does it follow that because one is not penalized for unintentionally killing a human fetus, that we may therefore intentionally kill one? Keep in mind, these guys don't intend to harm the woman or the fetus. They're duking it out with each other. They inadvertently make contact with her. She miscarries. That's very different than intentionally killing an innocent human being. So let's go back to our syllogism. Our syllogism isn't that it's always wrong to kill. Our syllogism is what? Wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. We're not dealing with an abortion here. We're dealing with something else. Third thing I would say, if you actually look at the documents in the original Hebrew, and Glesson Archer and others have done good work on this, it actually seems to point out that the lex talionis, the law of retribution, applies equally to mother and child. So I don't think this passage works, and only a couple translations of the Bible translate it to where the mother seems to have more value than the child. The Jerusalem Bible, the Revised Standard Version, and Bible jokes. Everybody else, it's more understood to apply equally to mother or child. Does that help? Good. All right.
Our next question comes from Britta. Britta's on our committee. Twice the summit, so I know this is going to be a good question.
This is a scary question when you get summit.
Thank you. There's a lot of pressure. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about assisted suicide and how humans are actually different than animals in that case.
Yeah, what about assisted suicide? What about animals? Let's take the animal one first. There are people, not that you did, but there are people who assert there's no difference between animals and humans, and that if we think humans are special, we're guilty of speciesism, valuing our own species above others. That's Peter Singer's view. I think Chris Kaser has a great response to this. He says, why don't you just cut to the chase with these people? Ask them this. Do you really think there's no difference between a hit and run with a squirrel and a hit and run with a newborn? Or is there no difference between eating a hamburger and eating a Harold burger, even if Harold is rather disabled? By the way, we don't believe that animals are the same as us, and I'm going to demonstrate it for you. How many of you remember the Michael Vick situation where he was abusing dogs? Here we have a professional football quarterback paid millions of dollars a year, and he's using his money to invest in dog fights where dogs would tear each other up and the losing dogs would be soused with gasoline and lit on fire. He got arrested, went to federal prison, rightfully so. Everybody was appalled by him, right? And they should be. Why are we appalled at Michael Vick? The dogs were tearing each other up. Were we appalled with them? We gave them a pass, didn't we? Why were you mad at Michael Vick? I'll tell you why. You expect better of him as a man, right? Dogs don't have conscience. We don't expect them to understand right and wrong. We do expect Michael Vick to. So I think intuitively we know there's a difference. On doctor-assisted suicide, euthanasia is where the doctor directly kills the patient through an injection or some other means. Doctor-assisted suicide is where he provides a prescription that the patient takes on his or her own, and that taking of the prescription brings on death. Oregon and 5 other states have that legalized. California, Vermont, I forget the other two.
The Montana is
going that way. Yeah, it could go that way. I think a lot of states could. Okay. As Christians, we want to be careful that we don't fall into the extreme of intending death or saying we must stop death at all cost. Death is going to come to all of us. The Christian must never intentionally kill an innocent human being. Doctor-assisted suicide would do that, therefore it's wrong. However, let's say you have Uncle Joe. He is in the final stages of cancer. He is dying. He will die. He is in pain, and your physician wants to dial up the level of morphine to make him more comfortable. But you can foresee that that could hasten death, even though the doctor doesn't intend death. Is it still okay to make Joe more comfortable? Yes, it is. Because you don't intend his death. What's killing him is the cancer. You're trying to make him as comfortable as possible as he goes through that. And by the way, you know why suicide or doctor-assisted suicide laws get a lot of traction in the culture? People are afraid of dying a painful death. And they're afraid Christians want to make them die painful deaths. And so they oppose us on this without understanding the distinction we're making between intending death and foreseeing it. Is this helping a little bit about where you were going? So, for example, I don't think as a Christian we must always stop death. I do believe we should never harm. We should never intend death. We can foresee it, but we don't intend it. Another case, somewhat related, would be ectopic pregnancy. A woman is pregnant, the embryo implants on the inner wall of the fallopian tube. If that embryo grows in that narrow tube, what's the risk to the mother? Going to hemorrhage. She dies from internal bleeding. So you're a doctor. What do? Do nothing and lose 2 humans? Or do you act in such a way that you save one life even though the unintended but foreseen result was the death of the embryo? You act to save the mother. Where in this case, death is foreseen but not intended. Same with what we're talking about here with the terminal patient who we withhold treatment that no longer benefits him. There could come, and there does come, in the final stages of some diseases where food and water no longer helps the patient. This isn't Terry Schiavo where we starve her to death and it's our unplugging her food that kills her. The patient's dying from an underlying pathology. In the final stages, food and water no longer help them, and therefore they should be withheld, not because we're trying to bring on death, but because it doesn't help the person. We respect the life the patient has, not the one we wish they had. And we do all we can to care for the life the patient has. Does that make sense? So that's how I would approach that.
One of the things, too, about physician-assisted suicide, don't assume that it's just the people that are under extreme pain and dying. As a matter of fact, if you look at Oregon or particular other countries, those statistics are vastly different. And if you want a full-blown version of this, Ryan T. Anderson's going to do it in July. It's one of the things he's going to address. Another question. John?
Yeah, I know there's some high school students in here. What advice would you have for them if they wanted to get more active in their high schools and maybe start a pro-life club? And so practical advice. And what practical / legal advice would you have for if they had a pro-life biology teacher?
If they just happened to have a pro-life.
If there happened to be one in Billings.
Just happened to be one in Billings that
who
appeared
wanted,
miraculously.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Thank you, John, who just happens to be one.
I know. We've been chatting. He's also a Biola guy, so I defer to Biola guys. I like those guys.
He can get over that, though.
No. It's the finest school you could go to for that, so went there myself. Anyway, regarding local laws of what you can do, obviously I don't know those laws. What I will say is this. I don't see how it would be wrong to lay out a pro and con case for each side of the abortion debate and ask students to examine the arguments and give fair treatment to both sides. I think we're at our best when we accurately represent the best arguments the other side can give, not when we make a character assassination of their arguments. So, for example, I respected David Boonin. I think he's wrong, but he's not a fool. And he's an intelligent man. In fact, I tend to bring him in to lecture to my students at Oklahoma Wesleyan because I want them to hear from the best. Because I think our case can handle that. So if I'm in your shoes, if, assuming the rules allow this, I would do joint pro and con pro-life presentations. I'd invite Planned Parenthood in one week, invite in pro-life speaker the next week, and let the students make up their mind. I think we win when that happens. I've been in those situations, and I don't think we've ever had a situation that I can imagine where the pro-life side did not come out on top of that. People remember our arguments. In fact, I would say it's almost better to do the pro and con than the debate in the actual class. The reason is it gives students time to reflect on who did the better case. So you bring one in one week, one the next. And then you discuss it with them, and I would say, in that sense, who could accuse you of being anything but trying to be intellectually credible and giving the students the best possible things to look at? Is that what you were asking me? I mean,
yeah.
Yep. And then as far as, what was the other one? There was students. Oh, students, what can they do? All right, first of all, students have got to master the moral logic of the pro-life view. So you need to get Life is Best TV series back there or get my book, The Case for Life, and get read up and studied up on this issue to know how to engage. After you do that, Congress passed a law, and the name escapes me, but it's the law that governs Fellowship of Christian Athletes Club, other things. They're allowed to form Bible clubs on secular campuses. And all it needs is a faculty sponsor. And if the campus allows any extracurricular club at all, it must allow a pro-life one.
My daughter, our second daughter, graduated from Miles City in 1989, Nancy. Is that right? Mm-hmm. There had been a Fellowship of Christian Athletes for a long time in Miles City. Miles City is a really holy town, you know.
Yeah.
There isn't one in Billings, Montana. We're going to change that.
Yeah, I'm going to think of the name of it. It was actually Phyllis Schlafly who got this going before she trumped reason on us recently. But anyway, that's a pun, bad pun. But that law that Congress passed that she helped push gives students the right to form a club on campus if the campus recognizes any other. I think it's called the Equal Access Act. That's it, Equal Access Act. So you could look that up. They could form a club. They could invite students to come and watch a video like what we showed last night. They could hear a case for the pro-life view. They could ask if there would be teachers that would let them come in as student guest lecturers. The teachers can say no, but they could ask. And then I would send those students to Summit. I would make sure they're here next month. For the next meeting in April, rather, to hear about Islam and what that does to the world. In other words, get them involved in Christian worldview to the extent that you can. So that's how I would start that. And then when they get to college, we've got more resources. We've got groups like Justice for All, Students for Life, and others who go out on college campuses, and we can get them involved. Dick, I don't want to stop if you don't want to, but we promise people.
A couple more questions and then we'll quit. This is a question from a lady, young lady in Great Falls who's written on this.
Thank you, Scott, for coming.
You're welcome.
You were mentioning about defending the unborn from conception. So I was wondering if you had just mentioned about birth control.
Yeah.
And the possibility of causing abortion.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Excellent question. How old is your baby, by the way?
5 months.
5 months. That's great. There is a debate among pro-life physicians and scientists over this question. Is there a secondary mechanism in Plan B and in most birth control cocktails or pills that triggers an abortion in the event of breakthrough ovulation? Meaning, should the woman get pregnant, despite the contraceptive nature of these pills, if she gets pregnant, does that cause the lining of the uterus to thin out, thus flushing out the embryo, triggering miscarriage. If you look at pro-life physicians in general, they're divided on this. It's not just a question of, is the peer-reviewed literature divided? Pro-lifers are divided, physicians. And there are several very high-profile pro-life physicians who say, it's crazy to say that this thing is abortifacient. And here's what they say. It's true that the labeling on the drug says it may cause miscarriage. Here's the problem, though. Labeling is not evidence. Labeling is lawsuit protection. Labeling cannot be accounted or counted as peer-reviewed New England Journal of Medicine, American Medical Association documentation that verifies empirical peer-reviewed research to establish a conclusion. You see the difference between labeling? And by the way, haven't we all seen drug commercials late at night? Take this drug, it will relieve you of depression. And then the guy starts talking at a million miles an hour. Side effects include you'll get heart attack, stroke, and you may jump off a building. You know, I mean, it's really crazy, right? Well, why is that guy talking? Is it because that's a likely outcome? No, it's not. He doesn't want to get sued. So, my answer is this. As pro-lifers, I think we need to be careful to not overstate our case here. I think it's fine to say that given the jury is still out, given these pills may cause miscarriage, we should probably err on the side of caution and not use them. That is respectable. What isn't respectable is what some pro-lifers are saying, this is an abortion pill. That just causes us to lose face with people, and they look at us and say, we do not know what we're talking about. And they're right when we put it that strongly. So my answer is that I do not know where the evidence is ultimately going to lead. I will say this, the latest stuff I've seen is indicating that not only is Plan B not a good abortifacient, it doesn't work at all. In fact, it's got real problems right now. Mm-hmm. So I would say I lean towards saying it's not abortifacient, but I'm not entirely certain. And I'll just be comfortable with that ambiguity until more evidence becomes available. So it's fine to say, look, based on the evidence and the fact that it could be problematic at ending a life, I'm going to err on the side of caution. I think you're fine to take that approach. Does that help?
Last question. Tony? One more. Guy drives all the way from Cody, Wyoming. Got to give me a question.
Where do we get the notes?
Notes? I didn't say anything about notes. That's just your view. All right. Here's what I did. This morning, I went to your Facebook, the great, the Big Sky Worldview Forum Facebook, and I posted a link to all of the notes on the Facebook page. However, I noticed as soon as I did that, it treats me as some alien visitor, and it made my post, I think, disappear. So you're going to have to go as the administrator, and, well, it's there. You just got to make it go prominent. So here's what you're getting, and here's what you're going to get. Get ready. I don't know why I'm so nice, but I did this. I not only give you the links to all the notes, I give you the links to the video clips of me teaching this pro-life apologetics course in London last October, so you get the video too. So, now notice I didn't do that till you all cleaned out the book table last night. No, seriously, I've given you the video and the notes. The links are all there. All you have to do is go to the Facebook page for the Big Sky Worldview Forum, and everything you are desiring is there. And by the way, students, that would be a great thing for your pro-life students to start with. Watch those videos.
In the back, was there...
What info? No. What I sent out last night was just to the Facebook page, to the Big Sky Worldview Forum. So all you got to do is go to their Facebook page, and there it is. Now, there were some ladies here tonight, and I think I see you, that asked me, could I print out some notes for you? I want you to know I tried this morning, but the hotel here, The wireless is down, and so are all the printers. I could not print them out. So what I'm going to do, if that was you, I'm looking, where are those delightful ladies I saw that asked if I would print out the notes? Yes, there you are. Okay, good. If you would do this, I'm going to email the two-page summary to Dick that I told you about that contains the main points we covered here. I'm going to email those to him and ask that he somehow find a way to get them to you or leave me an address, and when I get home, I will print them and mail them. But I tried this morning. I couldn't do it. The hotel printer didn't work.
If you see me, I'll take care of that. To the rest of you, if you're not on our email notification list, please sign up to get out in the lobby before you do that. Also, we've bloviated unapologetically about Summit Ministries, where Scott teaches regularly. If you're wondering what that is about, Nancy has some little brochures that she can give you. Last question.
Yeah, and you can go to that website frequently. It's full of wonderful information. What I wanted to, it seems to me that most churches are reluctant or even hostile to engaging their congregations in conversation about this issue. First of all, do you agree that that's true? Why do they do that, and what can we do about it?
Yeah. There is hesitancy. Hesitancy can come from two sources. One, the pastor doesn't want to risk talking about a controversial issue because he fears offending people or hurting people who've had abortions. Or he could be a pastor who cares about the issue but doesn't know what to do. I think as pro-lifers, we need to be careful issuing general condemnations of clergy who may be hesitating simply because they're not equipped, rather than believing they're all just the enemy and they're the bad guys and children are dying because of their silence. That generally won't get you a hearing with a pastor. So let me just address a couple of the reasons why they don't talk about this. They fear that they can't win on the issue, that they'll turn people off. The truth of the matter is exactly the opposite. If you get a skilled pro-life speaker who can present an intelligent and persuasive case for the pro-life view, you know what that says to non-Christians? It says to non-Christians that maybe, just maybe, the Christian worldview has something relevant to say on an important issue. And if the Christian worldview has something relevant to say on an issue like abortion, maybe we ought to look at its other claims as well. So it removes roadblocks to people coming to Christ when we give an intelligent and gracious presentation. And I've spoken in churches. That video I showed last night, I've shown this on in the main services of churches for 25 years now. And I'll tell you what, we don't have problems. I have a friend, Michael Sherrard, near me in Atlanta. And this guy, he wrote the book Relational Apologetics, great guy. And he, last October, took this video. I helped him put together a pro-life sermon. He has a ton of people in his church who are newer Christians, many of whom have had abortions. And they lined up with tears in their eyes to thank him for addressing the issue, because he used the pictures to point them to the gospel. We don't have to worry about, give people a guilt trip or tell the truth. No, use the pictures to point them to their Savior. When we don't talk about abortion, we don't spare women guilt. We spare them healing, because unconfessed sin has them out of full fellowship Absolutely. With their Savior. So we don't need to choose love people or talk about a horrible issue. We can love people and talk about the issue in a way that we point them to the truth and point them. Remember what I said last night? We open the casket on abortion, but we also open the truth of God's word that sinners can be reconciled. When you do that, you win. You win. And so I would try to determine what kind of pastor am I dealing with. Am I dealing with a guy who is just putting me off because he doesn't want to deal with it? Or am I dealing with a guy who really does have a heart to do something, but quite frankly, he's been turned off by some pretty bad pro-lifers in the past?